everyone, and welcome to episode 115 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobolski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. When it comes to the Middle Ages, the stuff that I'm most interested in is those details that are a fundamental part of everyday life, but that tend to be overlooked in wide sweeping views of history. One of those everyday details was definitely very important to the people at the time, and that was contraception. This week, I brought back one of my favorites, Dr. Eleanor Yanaga, to give us all the details on medieval contraception. Eleanor is guest teacher at the Department of International History of the London School of Economics and Political Science, and she's a contributor of all sorts of articles on medieval sexuality, which you can find from History Today to BBC History Magazine. Her blog, Going Medieval, busts myths on the regular, and she's been all over the podcast circuit lately. And she's put together a bunch of short documentaries on History Hit. Her book, The Middle Ages, A Graphic History, has just come out in the UK. She's a very busy, very public historian, so you can see why she's one of my favorites. Eleanor and I speak pretty candidly in this episode about sexuality and contraception, so if you're listening with kids who you're not ready to discuss this stuff with yet, feel free to come back to this episode later. It's also extremely difficult at times to talk about historical contraceptive practices without talking about abortion, because it's not always clear from the sources what the difference is in the use of certain remedies. So if this is a sensitive topic for you, you're welcome to come back next week, and you can check out some of Eleanor's other work in the meantime. But without any further ado, let's get into it. Here's our conversation on contraception, what was used, how it was used, and what medieval people thought about the whole idea. Well, thanks, Eleanor, for joining me to talk today about contraception. I'm always happy to see you, so thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a delight to be here, as usual.
We need to get into everything that you've done since the last time we saw you, but we'll do that at the end.
Yeah.
So we need to spare like 10 minutes for this because you have been a busy girl. But let's talk about contraception. So I think maybe the place to start is, I think contraception's always pretty much a women's issue. It tends to not be in the hands of men, at least in terms of something that maybe they have to think about as much. So what was the church's take on women and sex to begin with?
Well, okay, so the problem is that in the first place, the church is convinced that women are massively trying to get it constantly, right? So there's your first problem, right? So the church, it just accepts that, you know, women are these massively sexual creatures and, you know, they're kind of like men. It's sort of like, well, what if a man was horny? Then it would be a woman, actually. That's their way of thinking about it, because women are everything that men are not. So men are rational and holy and pious. Obviously, they're still sinful. But because the way that sin in general is considered, you know, that it's something that Eve brought into the world. And the way that the sin of Eve is conceptualized is a lot of the time as explicitly sexual, right? Because people didn't know they were naked up until that point. Up until that point, it would have, in theory, been possible to engage in sex without passion or pleasure. It would have just been, you know, kind of like a holy and specific act. So women are kind of responsible for sexual sin even existing in the first place. So women are more sexual, right? And so as a result, women are also more interested in having sex in the wrong ways.
The wrong ways, ways that you enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. Ways that you enjoy and ways that, like, it's not, you're not going to get pregnant, right?
Right.
Like the right way to have sex is to get pregnant. Like the only time that it's right to have sex is if you're explicitly being like, oh, got to have a baby. And then it's totally fine. You're not having any fun at all whatsoever.
Like then it's like,
yeah, it's like, I said there, any fun whatsoever. And it's like, no, you have to have exactly the right amount of fun, which is like just enough fun. You have to like orgasm as quickly as possible. It's like orgasm speed run. That's what sex should be. So it should be like orgasm speed run while doing penis and vagina sex while you're married in order to have a baby. And like, that's the ideal sex. So it's like, you know, we're talking 2 minutes tops, people, you know, and anything other than that is bad. So it is interesting because when we do hear about contraception, we still are hearing from men, though, even though it's a women's issue. And the way that we hear about it most often is like in penitentials, like penitential literature is where it comes up a lot, because there's a big concern that women do be doing contraception, though. And they're like, we've got to put a stop to this, you know? Yeah. So, and they know that they can't really do it kind of, you know, before the fact. So it's more like catching them. And it's interesting because when you do see it in penitential literature, it's like, well, you've got to make this intercession with women. So it's like, well, maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know that they shouldn't be doing it or whatever. And so there is a real concern and conception around, like, you have to make sure that they know they shouldn't be doing it, put them on penance, get them back on the right track, and make sure that they start having the procreative sex that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And so that's where we hear about it a lot, basically.
Yeah, I love that. So Penitential is a book that tells people what kind of penance they need to do when they sin. But I love, you'll read like guidelines and stuff that say you need to confess sometimes, like in the Ancren rule, the Ancren Nuissa, you have things saying like, tell the priest your sins, but not in a way that's going to shock him, especially if he's young.
Yeah.
There's also like penitential stuff being like, when you're taking a woman's confession, ask her about her sex life, but not in a way that gives her ideas, because we don't want to give her ideas.
Well, you know, and it's really crazy because when you see penitentials, they're full of ideas. It's, you're like, okay. You know, and there are more, some that are really kind of like famous for that. So for example, the Penitential of Bouchard of Worms has like all kinds of magic in it, where it's like, hey ladies, were you doing this magic? And it's like, were you cooking a live fish in your vagina and feeding it to your husband to make him love you? And it's like, girl, I don't know. So I mean, I imagine that if you were one of the priests who was attempting to use this, you'd have to do some lead-in questions, right? You'd have to be like, so are you... have you been trying to convince your husband to love you more in any way? You know, like, how do you get like straight to the fish in the vagina? You know, it's just like, without like telling her that that's possible, you know?
Like, have you done this in any way, like involving fish or not involving fish?
Have you been kneading bread down your naked body and then feeding it to your husband? It's like, girl, what? So there are all these things, because then even with that, it's like, did it involve food? Involve like honey or bread. I mean, obviously it doesn't tell you that, but I'm just kind of like extrapolating. I guess that's how you'd have to get there. But
but often when priests are asked to get someone's confession, one of the things is, have you drunk anything? It's usually drinking. Have you drunk anything that is going to prevent you from conceiving? And that is a pretty general question.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one too, because like, I mean, for us, particularly now that we know so much about conception and everything, it's sort of like, that's almost impossible. because there are things, of course, that you could drink that would be an abort efficient, for example. So like, you know, if you drink pennyroyal tea, enough of it, it is possible to miscarry, for example. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, one way of doing things. And it's interesting because for medieval people, there doesn't seem to be the same kind of idea of like, well, there's a differentiation between what we would call abortion early on and what they would call contraception. One of the things that I think is really interesting about even, you know, medieval clergy is that they are pretty chill about like miscarriages for like about 12 weeks or so. It's like, you've got the first trimester, that's yours. Right. They're like, yeah, fine. What I mean, like, it's bad. It's naughty. You shouldn't be drinking something that's going to make you miscarry. Okay. Like, that's bad. But the penances are relatively light if you have done it. And I mean, I think that's partially because they see the kind of other end of that as infanticide. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay. So if a woman is pregnant and really doesn't want to be, if it goes too far in one direction, then we're going to end up seeing actual dead babies. And that is a much different thing. Obviously, that is like really serious for obvious reasons, right? The, you know, medieval people are not that different to us. But at the same time, we sometimes see things in like medical recipe books and stuff where they'll be like, oh, well, here's something that you can drink to prevent conception. But a lot of time it wouldn't work. You know, like, God bless them, you know, they're trying and that sort of a thing. But, you know, it'll be make a tisane, stew some herbs together, you know, here are some things. And like, a lot of them suck, you know, it'll be like, oh yeah, have some wormwood mixed with this. And I'm like, well, that probably is going to taste nasty, but it's not actually going to be a contraceptive in any kind of like real way, right?
Yeah, it's probably not going to work. But I think that one of the things, so when I first came across it, I was reading John Riddle, and I think he probably is the person who knows the most about the herbal outside of that, unless somebody's updated since the time I was reading it. And he's listed a whole bunch of the herbs that people talk about. And a lot of them are listed in medical books, as you're saying, like they're to provoke the menses. They're to get the period going. And so I think I'm wondering if like that has to do with that first trimester thing where like the dudes are like, I don't know exactly how often this is supposed to happen. So can't really say it was a bad thing if you were just trying to get the flow going, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, that's one of these things where it's like, there's kind of like form of plausible deniability there as well, because they know that you should be having menses. So that is like the kind of recipe that you should have as well. Because it's like, well, yeah, if a woman goes for too long without having her period, and like, even if she's not pregnant, it is something that you want to bring on, because right, menses is conceptualized as this way of the body cleansing itself of ill humors. You know, and there's a whole bunch of misogynist stuff in there, of course. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh yeah, and then that, and also menstrual blood will like rot crops and grow gold. Yeah. And if a woman who's menstruating looks at you, you might be cursed. You know, there are all kinds of things on top of that. But it's still kind of like generally agree that it's something that should be happening. And in fact, like there are legends, for example, like there's the legend of the venomous virgin, which is something that comes up in the Alexander the Great stories, I think. But basically, it's a woman, a beautiful virgin, and everyone thinks that she's so hot. But if you touch her, you'll instantly fall down dead on the spot because her menses are so backed up that like all of the terrible things that are like corrupting elements are still inside of her. So you could have something that is used to provoke menses or used as a contraception. And that would be all right to put in your book. Because it's like, well, you can't get mad at me. Like, I don't, well, if a woman chose to use this in an incorrect way, who's to say? You know, so there's this like nice arm's length way of working with that, I think.
Yeah, exactly. That plausible deniability. And it's really super tied up with health and menses. I was just speaking with Monica Green not too long ago about the trotula.
Fangirl. Sorry, I love her.
I know. Yeah, we didn't get too much into the recipes of the trotula, but one of the things she says in the introduction is that Constantine the African, who she loves, fangirls about, says that, like, you know, women, they need to have sex to be healthy. They have to have sex to be healthy, but they also probably don't want to have kids. So, you know, it's not necessarily wrong that we have this information. So it's really kind of a twisted up thing for these Christian thinkers.
Yeah, it's really difficult because we see, for example, physicians grappling with this because it'll be like, well, yeah, women do need to have a certain amount of sex because there's the idea that women have semen, right, under the two-seed theory. And so women need to expel that semen or they will become ill. And that this is one of the things that can make like uteruses start wandering around in the body, for example.
Yeah, we should get to that in a second.
So that's a problem. And it's really funny because when medical men are talking about this, they're like, okay, well, the first thing that you should do with this is if you've got like an unmarried woman, get them married, right? Like get them married and like get them having sex because that'll sort that. And then they're like, yeah, but sometimes young girls or unmarried women and will masturbate. You know, they don't say that. But but it's really funny because the way that they talk about it is they're like, oh, so they will imagine a dick. They'll start thinking about a dick in their head and they'll kind of like rub themselves. And then that is how they will like expel their humors. And I just think it's so funny because like these medical guys are completely unable to even conceptualize like women's sexuality without like, oh no, but there's still a dick there. You know, and it's like, okay, yeah, like that's what they've got to focus on in order to masturbate. And they will say also, okay, like, and so in order to kind of prevent that, because that's a sin, you could have like medical intervention. So you could have like a midwife or something. And then they'll be like, midwives essentially could jack these women off. Like that's what they recommend. They're like, oh yeah, like have them oil their hands up with like oil of iris and just get in there. And it's like, okay, you know, that's one way of doing it. And they're like, and that's fine, right? Because they say it's like curative. And so there's this whole thing where it's like, well, yeah, the hand that cures cannot corrupt is what they say about it. But it is interesting because they like explicitly say, well, this is a job for a midwife. Like you don't want a male physician doing this. This is women's business. But they kind of agree that it needs to happen and that otherwise women can become ill.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the logic sometimes just makes me laugh. But anyway, let's talk about wandering wombs for a second because I think it's hilarious.
Well, it's really interesting because it is hilarious in the first place. So it's like, this idea goes back to the Greeks. I mean, all of these ideas go back to the Greeks. Like basically, yeah. if there's something that's particularly like wild in the medieval period, actually the Greeks came up with it, and medieval people were like, yeah, sure, wandering wombs, why not?
100%.
And there's this way of thinking about the uterus, what they call it, the womb, as specifically like an animal is how the Greeks talk about it. And it's like, it's a little animal and it will crawl around inside of women. And it becomes a real issue because it can like interfere with other organs and it can make you really unwell if it moves into the wrong position. And so it's interesting because a lot of just generalized illnesses and maladies, both the ancient Greeks, well, and Romans, and medieval people, they'll go, yeah, this is a wandering womb problem. They'll be like, I don't know, man, I've got stomach ulcers. And they're like, yeah, your problem is your womb is up on your stomach. And it's this little animal that's moving around. And in order to counter that, according to the Greeks, your best bet is to get a woman pregnant.
Well, yeah.
Because, you know, obviously, because like the pregnancy will then pin the womb in place because it's like, uh-oh, I've got to breed this baby now. I can't like, and it just kind of like stays in place. So it's interesting because it almost kind of theorizes like the natural state of a womb as pregnant. The ideal womb is a full womb. And, you know, any issues that you are having with it, a lot of the time, they will be like, yeah, you should just get pregnant. Why don't you get pregnant? Like, why don't you, like, and it's just sort of like, it seems so, like, from the point of view of, like, as a uterus owner myself, I'm like, that seems to me, like, to be more of a problem in a lot of ways, like, especially when you consider, like, high mortality rate in birth and things like that. But fine, you know, like, I personally wouldn't choose to... But fine, you know, that's kind of the way that they see it.
You got to be careful, though. It might end up in your elbow. You just don't know.
You don't know. Where's that guy going? You know, but I love this idea of this kind of like you know, little octopus uterus having a little go around.
Yeah, and you have to tempt it back into the right place. Like if it's too low, you have to like smell things that will bring it up. And if it's too high, you have to like fumigate. You're a lady, but
yeah. There's a lot of fumigating. It's really interesting because do you remember a couple years ago, like Gwyneth Paltrow, of course it was Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right, yep.
She was recommending like to steam your vulva with mugwort. It was like you're supposed to sit on a special chair and then it would like put mugwort steam into your vagina and that was supposed to be good for something. And I was like, this is actually so medieval. You know, like people use the word medieval to mean like bad or stupid or whatever. I'm like, no, but this really is like, yeah, oh yeah. The thing that would be good for your vagina is like get some herb steam right up in there. And like that would be, it's like, yeah, it does sound like you're trying to coax the womb back down, right? Like,
yeah. Naturally, that's going to be the next thing that we see coming out of that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. So
we've talked about herbs and we talked about like some of the theory and stuff. But one of the things people could do that might have actually worked is using pessaries. So can we talk for a sec about pessaries?
Yeah, so there's a lot of pessaries. So it would be, you know, you would grind up various herbs and again, just right up in there. Bang. Yeah, you know. And pessaries, we think, are probably a bit more useful because it's like it can sort of change the pH of like whatever's going on in there. And like, so for example, the IUD that we use now is essentially this, which is really interesting because like an IUD as opposed to an IED, but an intrauterine device, it's literally like, yeah, just put some copper in your cervix because copper kills sperm. And fun fact, we don't know why. We just know that it does, right? So
We just need to know it does.
Yeah. And so, you know, it is possible, the point is, like, to kind of put things into one's vagina that will interfere with semen or sperm and get in the way. There is also kind of like the possibility of just like straight up blocking. So it's like it makes it very difficult for semen and sperm to get through. So that is within the realm of possibility. And to be honest, to steal a line from my long-suffering sex educator boyfriend, it's really actually kind of difficult to get pregnant. It's sort of like instances of pregnancy. It's something like one in every 10 times or like first time sex. I don't know. I'm like looking over my shoulder because I'm going to see him be like, no, you're doing the numbers wrong. So the point is, it's actually kind of difficult to get pregnant. And so when you introduce actually any kind of pessary or some other thing that like a hurdle that sperm have to get over, even if it isn't like necessarily copper or something that we know definitely works, we do know that that is going to bring that down. So, you know, and it's actually a real problem that we have today where people will just assume that they're going to get pregnant really easily because the way sex education and stuff works out, it's like, you're going to get pregnant. Like, you know, having sex is this dangerous thing. And then when people are like, okay, I'm ready to get pregnant, it's like, oh, why isn't this that, you know? And so medieval people are kind of like, oh yeah, well, this is something that'll definitively work. And if we're like, I don't know if the science isn't there, but the science is kind of there on the fact that it's like, if you introduce any obstacles, it can be quite difficult. That's all.
Yeah. We certainly don't advocate for any of the recipes that we might
do. Please do. Please do not use the tarantula.
Don't use it.
Don't do that. Please see your healthcare professional.
But some of the things, some of the methods I think are still very similar, like the sponge thing, like people soak something, put it in there, and again, disrupt the pH. I think the most famous example is that one from Montaillou. Do you want to talk about that one? That pessary? Where it's the pessary is, she's wearing it around her neck.
So she's wearing it around her neck, and it's like the dick and balls, right? Of a of like a horse, like of some animal, and it's like, yeah, just put some dick and balls on your that'll be fine. And you're like, what?
There's a goat one from the Trotula, but I'm thinking of one where it's the priest, that horrible priest, gives her this pest. Well, we think it's a pessary. She wears it around her neck, and he says, before you have sex, you have to put it in the entrance of your stomach. So it seems like this is a pretty naive woman, and she has to put this there. But what is interesting about this case is that he provides it. The priest provides it.
The priest provides it, yeah.
And he tells her how to use it, which I think is pretty interesting.
Priests are dodgy. No, isn't it? Like, I mean, this is priests, some of my favorite people in the medieval period, because they are actually having rather a lot of sex.
Yeah, a lot.
Like, a lot. Like, a lot, a lot. It's like, being a priest, it seems to be quite a good way of getting play and also being able to, like, not get married.
That's true.
Yeah, no, I'd forgotten about this one, actually. Yeah, it's quite interesting because, so, for example, I come across priests all the time who are, especially seeing sex workers or like running brothels. This is like a big thing in Prague. There's like constantly priests running brothels and like living with women. But I'm really obsessed with also like the priests in, have you ever read like the Good Woman of Languedoc, Beatrice's Confession? It's like during the Cathar Inquisition.
That's the one I think we're talking about.
Right. So it's like, I completely forgot about the past, but yeah, like, so all these people are like, you should become a heretic. That's the word they use. And she's like, why should I do that? And they'll be like, so we can bone, girl. And she's like, but why? Wait, that doesn't even make any sense. And they're like, well, yeah, because, and she's like, isn't the idea that like sex is sinful? And they're like, yeah. But like, sex is always sinful. And she's like, okay, so why should we have sex? And they're like, and she's like, shouldn't you only have sex with your husband? And they're like, no, see, that's actually more sinful because you think it's not sinful to have sex with your husband, and it is sinful. So it's actually less sinful to have sex with me, some priest, because you know it's sinful, which makes it less sinful. And she's like, girl, what? And like, all these priests, like, and it's like, there's multiple priests.
Yeah.
It's not even just like the one. There's like, there's like two or three, and they're like hiding under her bed. And like, anyway, I'm obsessed with these guys because they're like, A, they are priests, but they're actually like heretics. And they're, and they don't really seem to be interested in this particular heresy for any reason other than getting in Beatrice's pants, as it were.
Yeah,
I forgot. Oh my God, I completely forgot about the pessary bit.
Yeah.
You got me again.
So. Dude, you can't know everything all the time at the tip of your brain. So, you know, give me this.
Luckily, between the two of us, we can, I think. You know.
Let me have this one. Well, I have been obsessed with the idea of contraception, like since I was an undergrad, like since I came across the Trotula and stuff like that. So like, this is stuff that I just love to think about and talk about. Because it's so interesting, because theoretically there's all those issues, like when is it okay, when is it not okay. I think it's probably worth mentioning that in Islam it was acceptable. Like, there are plenty of reasons why women don't want to have kids. The fact that they might be poor, the fact that it's dangerous, you know, they might not want to. And so it was a different thing for Islamic physicians, which is interesting because that is the medical stuff everybody was reading across Europe.
Yeah. Because it's like everyone agrees that it's like, well, that's the good medicine, right? It's like you want the Islamic stuff, that'll be good. So, and it's not as though we see that for example, redacted when it gets into like the Latin canon. So, you know, when it goes over to, you know, Spain, gets translated back out and then gets into the European population, they're not like, oh yeah, and get rid of this. They like, they still keep it around. So it's interesting because it just seems that like from a Christian point of view, there's a lot more lip service. So like, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. Whereas in Islam, well, I mean, Islam also has kind of like a chiller view of sex also. Where they're like, yeah, it is pretty fun though, am I right? You know, that's like, that's kind of like the Islamic medieval view of it. And they're like, yeah, I mean, like, obviously, probably you should get married, but then they're all like those, like the short marriages you can do. You can be like 24-hour marriage, baby, you know, and stuff like that. So there's like a lot of ways around the strictures there. Whereas from a medieval, like Christian point of view, it's like, oh yeah, even within marriage, it's ideally I wouldn't. You know, like think of all like the pairs of, for example, married saints that you see in the medieval period, and they're great because they get married and they're like, yeah, but let's like pinky swear to definitely not fuck. Okay, great. You know? and the church is like, we love this. Just so you know, like
this is perfect. This is great.
Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, fine.
Might be slightly unhealthy, but you know,
who's to say? Who's to say? There are all these kind of different ways of relating to it in like Islam, or, you know, sometimes also within Judaism, we'll see like a different approaches to sex. Whereas within Judaism, like, again, like it's a bit chiller than Christians. And there is the same kind of like moral panics around women being quite horny we see in Judaism. And interestingly, like, for example, Ruth Mazzucaris has highlighted that there will be like, there's a specific panic about Jewish women attempting to have sex with Gentiles, because there is this idea that circumcision makes the penis more sensitive. The foreskin acts as kind of like a sheath, so Gentiles don't feel sex as much. So there's a panic that Gentiles last longer in bed. So Jewish women might want to have sex with them. So that they can have like really long bouts of sex. And it's quite interesting because obviously this is the exact opposite of how we feel about circumcision now. But like Jewish people then were like, well, this is a, you know, at least some were stressing about this.
See, you got me this time. I did not know that, but now I will never forget it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's in Sexuality in Medieval Europe, Doing Unto Others. So,
okay. Yeah. I did read that. I must have just run over that one. Like, there's a lot to take in with that book.
There's a lot, right? So, you know, like, trust me, where I'm like, girl, what's this about a dick? You know, that's that's the bit I remember. So, you know, like denigrating one of the great medievalists' work, but it's fine.
She has a sense of humor for sure.
Oh yeah, she's amazing. I just love her.
Serious fangirling. Okay. Mm-hmm. One more question I want to ask you about contraception, and then I want to talk about all the amazing things you've been doing. Okay, so contraception, I think the last biggest controversial thing is people are not sure where women were getting this advice from. Like, we're talking about physicians and priests sometimes being whores, but like midwives get a bad rap. Especially at the end when they start to appear in like the Malleus Maleficarum as being midwives are responsible for anything with no babies. So what do you think?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there was this sort of like school of thought for a while. People were saying, oh yeah, well, you see this kind of like blame of midwives. The way that people feel about midwives really changes along with the professionalization of medicine. So when medicine becomes more like something where you definitely have to have a doctorate, right? Then that excludes women because women can't go to university because everyone at university is a cleric. So that means that women are necessarily excluded from becoming physicians. And so then there was like an extrapolation from that, which was like, oh yeah. And then that's why people blame midwives for like being witches, because they're already doing something illegal, which is that they are practicing medicine while women. But that actually doesn't seem to be the case. And what we tend to see, for example, when we do see in the early modern period, for example, midwives who are tried as witches or hung as witches, it's usually because they were performing abortions. Because midwives, right, are just like a generalized OBGYN of the medieval period, essentially. It's like, yeah, they're like, you got some women in trouble, you go see a woman. And partially that is because of the way bodies are conceptualized. And again, like the way women are supposed to be inside out men, women are just like not quite people. So the default is always like a man. So that's what men would learn at. And like for everything else, like just go get a midwife. There's also, you know, the part of that, because it's like, well, in like a small village. So we're saying the great majority of medieval people are living in the countryside. The great majority of medieval people are peasants. They're probably never really going to have access to a physician. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not going to happen for them. But they will have a midwife, right? Because everybody has babies. And there's going to be some woman in the local community who looks after this, right?
Yeah.
So there is going to be, like, some possibility of this woman doing abortions. And so if they can, for example, give you contraceptives, if they're like, oh, well, here's a pessary. You know, like, that might be something you could ask. If they're doing abortions, those are decisively sinful actions. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it seems to kind of snowball to, like, midwives in general are a problem. But, you know, to be fair, midwives continue to be a thing. Like, you know, there is like a definite suspicion about them on the part of church people. And, like, yes, some are definitely hung. But at the same time, like, we shouldn't go too overboard is what I always caution here, because it's like, there's still a lot of midwives around the shop. Like, it's still expected that you're going to need a midwife. We don't see an attendant kind of roll over to, oh, you should have a physician to all of your birthing things. It's like, everybody knows that that is not going to be something that is actually on the cards. So yeah, it does seem to be tied specifically to abortion, to contraception, to these things that are necessarily sinful. And because, like, in the Malleus Maleficarum, a big way that women's sin is conceptualized, and one of the reasons why women become witches is because they're so sexual.
Yeah.
So it's like, and they just want to fuck the devil. You know, their words, not mine. Like, they're just like, yeah, women are absolutely desperate to shag the devil. And that's why they become witches. So midwives would be kind of like a part of this, because even if they're like a good midwife, right, who's just only delivering babies, that's still kind of like, you know, the end point of sexuality. So it's like all of this is kind of bundled up in the late medieval and early modern mind. And so it's just kind of like translates to midwives are bad, even if they are extremely necessary.
Yeah. It's tricky because it's not like midwives were writing stuff down, because they are going to be people who are not super literate at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it makes sense to me that they would be the ones who would know about what you should use for contraception, because they are the ones who know about what you should not do when you're pregnant. So like, we can reverse that and say
completely. And I mean, it makes perfect sense. You know, it is the kind of stuff that, like, gets passed between people, you know, the sort of like medical information. And it's like, you would know, you'd be able to reverse engineer it at the very least, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I could talk about this with you forever.
I know, right?
we're going to do that someday over a drink. But right now, since you've been on the podcast, your career has blown up. Coincidence? I don't know.
Directly related, baby. You know, this is the stepping stone. This is where it happens for people, right?
That's right. I launch everybody.
Yeah. You gotta, if you don't make this, you're never making it anywhere. That's it. You know.
That's right. But I'm so happy for you, because you, it's blown up for you. You're on every podcast. You're on History Hit. We can't list all the podcasts, but let's talk about your shows then. That's easier to list. So what have you done for TV that people can see on History Hit?
Yeah. So on History Hit TV, which you can go to historyhit.com, and it's sort of like a Netflix, but for history. So there's lots of different history programs there. So I've got one show that's one off that's called Life and Death in Medieval London, where basically I marched a camera crew around London, talked their heads off. They got very like confused. But basically what I was attempting to do is kind of like talk about various communities within London and how London worked as a kind of like a contiguous whole with different communities and how that makes a larger one. Now, more recently, I think the fourth one is coming up soon, coming out. I've got a series, which they are calling Going Medieval, and it attempts to talk about like the various estates in the medieval period. So I've got one show on peasants, one show on guilds, one on the clergy, and one on the nobility. So it's a kind of like, again, England specific, because I live in England, and I don't know if you've heard this, but there's been a global pandemic.
Really?
So yeah. So I haven't been able to get out much. So it does kind of like attempt to talk a bit about how various parts of study work. I, in particular, am very pleased with my peasants episode, because I will never tire of talking about normal people.
It's so true.
But they're the interesting ones, right? Yeah, sure. 80% of people are interesting, actually. Like, you know, I'm tired of talking about the same five rich dudes. I'm over it. Not interested. I want to talk about like what's going on the farm. I want to know about their forms of contraception. I want to talk about the three field system, girl. Like, that's what's up. That you can watch anywhere in the world. So yeah, do check that out if you are so inclined. I got to go to a castle and stuff. So it was pretty cool, like during lockdown, because I got to go to a couple places, because I was like, well, I'm working.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
I'm alleviating the suffering of others right now.
Well, I'm sure you aren't breathing on people. I should mention, though, that you are coming out with your own podcast, which is not on a regular schedule, as I understand it, right? So it comes out when it comes out?
Yeah. So basically, I've got my We're Not So Different podcast, which I do with my friend Luke. We don't know how long we're going to be doing it for. We've got quite a few at the moment. I think it tends to come out, like it comes out when it comes out, but there's usually one a week.
Okay.
And basically it is, as the name kind of indicates, is where we're trying to like track the things that are really similar in terms of like a medieval society and our own. So in the middle, we are in the middle of like a little peasant stint at the moment. So we've been talking about peasant rebellions. We're on Twitter at WNSDpod. And you know, you can check us out. We're Not So Different. We're across all podcast platforms. So that is fun and diverting, I find. So I've got that. Yeah, that's another thing.
And then you have your blog, which is still going, and you do original content for Patreon. I'm gonna have to put a lot of links in these show notes, girl. But
oh, I know. Yeah. So yeah, on my Patreon, I've got original content as well. So at the minute, like, you know, if I get more subscribers, I'm going to commit to doing more things per month. But at the minute, we do an audio one every month. So it's usually the second week of the month where I read and kind of like show you how to analyze primary sources. So I'll pick a primary source and like I read it and we'll go through it and I'll kind of like explain it bit by bit so that people can have a look about it. And then at the end of the month, I usually do a video and it's usually me talking to like one of my other medievalist friends about whatever. Although, you know, sometimes it will be things like, you know, lectures I've given or, you know, other talks like that. So it really depends. But in general, there will be some kind of a video. And I also very helpfully round up all of the bullshit I do so that people can find where I've done everything. So yeah, and that helps to support the blog. From £1 a month, all of this could be yours, basically.
That is a steal.
I know.
Okay, the last thing that we're super excited about is your book is out. Your book is out. Tell us about your book.
Yeah, so my book, it just came out today as I'm recording it in the UK. It is called The Middle Ages, A Graphic Guide. And as the name suggests, it's essentially like, you know, think a graphic novel, but for history.
This time you're not doing the other graphic.
Yeah, not that. Not this time. What I have attempted to do with it is it's essentially like my first year introduction to medieval history courses, but in a comic book form. So if people like have absolutely no knowledge about medieval history at all whatsoever, that you can pick this up and have a look at it. It's great for basically teenagers up to adults. I aimed it at an adult audience, but teenagers can handle it, I assure you. And it's not that kind of graphic, so it'll be okay. I promise. In it, I mentioned that sex exists. So that's kind of like basically it. So I know you're going to be shocked to learn that sex exists. But so that is out today. If you're in the UK, you can pre-order, though, in North America, and you will get it in September. Although someone said to me that they had like ordered through Book Depository in the UK, and they were like, we're getting theirs in America. And I was all like, this is pretty eager. I don't know if you really want to pay that much for postage, but if you're absolutely desperate to have it now, you could, I guess. I mean, I would probably wait till September personally, but, you know, yeah.
It's very exciting. It's hard to wait until September when, you know, all your UK friends are like, we got this book and it's amazing. It's hard to wait.
I'm really fielding a lot of like, hey, what about us is from North America at the moment. I'm like, sorry, it's not my fault. But and in Australia and New Zealand, it's going to be out on Ellen and Unwin, and I think that's also September, so.
Yeah, that's how it works in publishing, unfortunately. But I think we're all used to that by now.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, it's, you know, this is nice for me because usually it's the opposite for me. Like, I'm usually waiting for something in the UK from America. So, look, it happens sometimes, right? This is just how it is.
It's our turn to wait. And, you know, I'm in Canada, so we always have, you know, an extra bit tacked on there. But I can't wait to read it. So thank you. Thank you for coming on, talking about contraception, telling us what you're up to. It's always good to see you.
It's so wonderful to visit, as always. You know, I think that you can hear the enthusiasm coming off of this.
Yes. Yeah. It's like being a fly on the wall sometimes with you and me.
I know, right? Oh, God.
I love it. Thanks. To find out more about Eleanor's work, you can visit her blog at going-medieval.com, or you can follow her on Twitter at goingmedieval. You can support her work and get extra content at patreon.com/goingmedieval. And her new book is The Middle Ages, A Graphic History. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on this week, Peter?
Hey, hey. We have Alice Sullivan writing a wonderful piece just in time for the summer solstice. It looks at the use of sunlight in medieval churches. And so she focuses on a 15th century church in Romania. It's absolutely beautiful pictures and a video that go with it. So I strongly recommend it. It's a real nice, fun piece to look at. Also got the final installment of James Turner's series on King Arthur. This time he's looking at the never-ending debate on King Arthur's historicity. So fun times. Plus, we got pieces on life on the Byzantine-Arab frontier and the story of Maria Comnenus. All that.
Wow.
And more.
Yeah, that's a lot of cool stuff.
Thanks to Alice for that wonderful piece.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, that sounds awesome. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for all your support in making this podcast possible every week. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of amazing rewards like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our very own maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. Summer is here, and that means it's time to register for the summer session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators and get your work in progress back in progress. This is a 6-week online course that I put together with some awesome experts to help people creating medieval fiction to get all of those nitpicky details that they need without having to spend hours lost on the internet. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing to textile work, and we do it all with helpful bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. You can even ask me anything. The next class begins Friday, July 9th. For all the details, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from Arthur to authors, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, all over social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.